Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Timothy B. Tyson and Mary D. Williams, co-authors of Mahalia Jackson, Moving On Up a Little Higher, the story of an American civil rights pioneer. It is a great pleasure to welcome Timothy B. Tyson and Mary D. Williams to The Reading Life. Tim is Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and the author of 5 books, including the best-selling The Blood of Emmett Till. Mary is a gospel singer, civil rights historian, and former adjunct professor at Duke University. She's performed at the Kennedy Center and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They are the co-authors of a new biography, Mahalia Jackson, Moving On Up a Little Higher, the story of an American civil rights pioneer. Tim, Mary, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having us.
Now, this is an inspired collaboration. So how did it come about?
Sure. When I was on tour with Blood Doesn't Sign My Name back in 2004, I was speaking at a local urban ministries for as a benefit, and they got Mary to come sing because they knew how much I liked gospel music. And I was just blown away by her voice and her spirit, and immediately afterwards asked her if she would work with me. That was many years ago, and we've since then traveled together talking about books and music, and we've also we taught a course at Duke University together for 16 years.
Wow.
That's how you really get to know a person.
Yeah, and Mahalia was part of my grounding earlier, but she was pivotal to Mary, as she can tell you. And then Mahalia Jackson became a big part of our teaching work together. Yeah. We eventually decided to write this book after all that.
Now, when you're describing the book, you say you want to give her her proper due as a civil rights pioneer. Why do you think that hasn't been in the forefront before?
I think that has a lot to do with framing. I think that, you know, Tim and I talk about this a lot. When in terms of, and I can use myself for an example, it's more to me than just being a gospel singer. But because of the power of her voice and the impact that she had, people tend to really highlight that because her voice was powerful, moving. It did what other voices could not do in terms of bringing people together. And what we talk about, the racial coalition, to really bring people together, to want to be together, to want to work together and still hold up their cultural identity. So I think that she was put in this box. And so as we began to do the research, we found out, you know, as early as the 1930s, that she was so involved and so engaged in the movement in so many ways that went far beyond her being just a gospel artist or a performer. And so that was what intrigued me, the power of her voice and the whole culture of an African-American woman being able to come out of what she came out of and be as effective as she was, and then to see her influence.
Now, don't you think every generation, you know, deserves a new biography, you know, because you need to take these icons and dust them off a little bit, look at them in a new way, I think.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. As Mary was pointing out, the research, we had not really thought of Mahalia Jackson as primarily a civil rights pioneer, but the research led us there. It was there in the historical record, just nobody had really looked at it.
Now let's talk about her early years in New Orleans and nearby places. I mean, her story begins in a place in Louisiana called Gum Stump, and a family descended from enslaved people. And you write, she may not have lived in Gum Stump, but Gum Stump lived in her. And you write that. So talk about why that is so important.
Well, for me, when we talk about the ancestors, we have to think about what was going on. We have to think about being on the actual plantation where her ancestors were enslaved. So we have to understand that the stories, everything that was poured into her during those times, and as it relates to the different hardships, the different issues that she and her family faced. And so generation after generation, they're kind of coming out of it gradually, you know, as laws and emancipation things occur, but it's still embedded in her from her ancestors, the music, the stories, the emotion behind it. And one of the things that was important is that for me, the songs that I share or that I perform, I didn't learn those songs out of a book. I learned those songs from my grandmother. My grandmother used to say, from her mouth to my ears. And so Mahalia, you know, really encompasses all of that and brings that along with her.
Now, Tim, you have this wonderful passage of how Mahalia Jackson used everything that was a part of her in her work. And I wonder if you would read that now.
Sure. Whether Mahalia Jackson sang to millions in the nation's capital and on national television, or to a few dozen gathered at a crossroads church, she sang like God Almighty rattling down the Delta in a driving rain, like a northbound train roaring up from the levee bottom of New Orleans to the south side of Chicago. Even as she swung like her jazz idol Duke Ellington, even as she wailed like her blues teacher Bessie Smith, she hewed close to her roots in the black spirituals and the gospel music to which they gave birth. Born in New Orleans in 1911, she died at the age of 60 in Chicago in 1972, in some respects a martyr to her tireless work for the civil rights movement, still using her voice to reveal and inspire universal freedom and love, human and divine, from the living ingredients of her own particular Southern black woman's experience. She told a music critic after her stellar performance at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1958, "The way they did them in the fields or in their homes and sang these songs, that's the way I love to sing them. I don't sing them the way they do in the choir. I sing them like they did in the cornfields, like a message, like a deliverance."
Now, she grew up in a part of New Orleans that we still know as the Black Pearl. So talk about her early life. She had a rough childhood and an uncertain family life and grew up the hard way.
Her mother died when she was very young. Her fa father, her biological father, was never a real father to her. She never lived in the house with him. He had a wife and other children that he acknowledged, but did not really acknowledge Mahalia. She grew up with her aunts, and it was a hard scrabble life. She had to work very hard doing housework and rearing children and really suffering.
And the Black Pearl was right next to the railroad tracks.
Yeah, she was in one of the poorest sections of New Orleans, right there by the tracks. The tracks on one side and a sanctified church on the other, where she could hear the spirited gospel of the sanctified church pouring out into the street, which had a lot of effect on her musical style too.
And she had dropped out of McDonough 24 by by her early teen years. And so she was working young. And you write that work songs were an important part of her musical vocabulary.
Right, but, well, being in the area in which she was, and you would have to understand how that music worked within itself, because when you think about railroads, when you think about the work, the work chants were a vital part of getting the work done. So she's immersed again in all of this. This is everyday life. This is something that she born into, grows up into, and invests herself in it. And so when you hear, she never sings one song the same way, but when you hear her, you hear different aspects of jazz or blues or the chants, even when she's kind of repetitive in some of her renditions. So she just it's there. And the beautiful thing about Mahalia, because she was not vocally trained, she did what she did based on how the songs affected her, how it moved her. And then she was able to actually share that with the audience because there's this relationship, we call it triangular. You know, she's with her and God and God and the people. So she has these experiences. And the beautiful thing about it, whenever she sings, it becomes that kind of performance.
And you write that by the time she was four, she was in a choir at church. That
Yes,
young,
yes.
that young. And then by the time she was 14, she had received the Holy Ghost. And Mary, I'd love it if you'd read that passage about how that kind of spiritual energy spreads through a crowd of people.
For me, born half a century later than Mahalia, the legacy of the enslaved Rush Arbor Church had lost none of its power. Her great-great grandmother, which passed down stories of that church through my grandmother and mother. These incendiary secret gatherings, they explained, had no order of service, no pre-planned liturgy, but instead let the power of the Spirit erupt from the freedom and passion of those gathered. Let the Spirit roll, they believed. And at Willow Springs Free Will Baptist Church in Clayton, North Carolina, more than a century after the fall of slavery, when I was growing up, the rural Black church in the South preserved the old ways. I recall the music erupted from the spirit. One worshiper would begin to sing, "I wish somebody's soul would catch on fire. I wish somebody's soul would catch on fire." A chorus repeated over and over again until somebody would get the Holy Ghost and collapse or dance in religious ecstasy. Others would be captured by the spirit too and join in until the whole congregation rocked. There was no plan, but just a common letting go, pulled forward by the music and the singers.
We get that at Jazz Fest in the gospel tent, you know, every year. But when she got to Chicago in the 30s, she became part of a gospel movement. So, talk a little bit about what that movement was and how it was different from what she'd been doing before.
What we have to realize is that this great migration, when African Americans are moving to the leaving the South, they're going in groves by to go north to a place where they can have liberty. But one thing about it is this whole idea, and we do talk about this in the book in terms of the new Negro, this whole idea of wanting to change how African Americans were received. And so, whether it was the Fisk Jubilee Singers, even the choir started being established. Remember, we're talking about choral music, where the somebody would start off singing. For example, just like that song, "I wish somebody's soul would catch on fire, catch on fire, catch on fire." So the leader would start, and then the chorus, the congregation would just join in, and in this whole call and response. But when we get to this era, in terms of the new Negro, it's wanting this whole idea, wanting to be more organized. So they start using gospel music that was, you know, we know that was brought forward by Thomas A. Dorsey, but we also know that they start doing vocal parts. They start harmonizing. They start developing choirs. They start using sheet music. So it's this whole idea, not just this new wave of how music is performed, but in turn, and now it's called gospel music also. You know, we're not talking about spirituals and hymns. We're talking about gospel music, which is music that is actually brought up from the text. Whether it's New Testament or Old, remember the spirituals primarily come up out of the Old Testament. And so this music is coming up and erupting in this vocal harmony. And so it's all about imagery also, because this is how the Baptist Church wants to portray themselves, that they're in choir robes and their vocal parts. And this whole aesthetic and how music is displayed or demonstrated comes along.
And this was a time when Mahalia Jackson found one of her signature songs, which was the title of your book, Moving On Up a Little Higher. And it was by Herbert Brewster, who was a Memphis pastor. And I wonder if you'd read his definition of gospel, Tim.
Brewster asked an interviewer years later, "What is a gospel song? You can't tell everything that it is." He believed that a good gospel song had everything that a prayer has. It has adoration. It has supplication. It has every phase of Christian life, dealing with every problem that can arise in a human being's life. The lyrics, he thought, must always lean toward freedom, saying, "I got to sing a brand new song." Long before anyone chanted "Black Power" or "Black is Beautiful," Brewster's gospel songs and sermons embodied an assertive racial pride and dignity. But the word gospel, Brewster insisted, also means dynamite, and gospel was always subject to explode.
I love that so much. What a writer he was.
Yes.
Oh, he really was.
And she sang for funerals and tent revivals, and when she needed to supplement that income with other work, she had a beauty parlor in her house and learned the craft from one of Madam C.J. Walker's schools, a Louisiana link.
Yeah, it was, I think about this all the time, that Mahalia, you know, she was making money out of all entities in terms of, you know, sometimes doing the hair of the deceased, singing a song, you know, being the psalmist at the funeral. So, yeah, she was amazing.
And then came Ed Sullivan and the toast of the town and a wider recognition. So I want you to talk a little bit about that mainstream success and what that meant for her.
So when she gets on the Ed Sullivan show, this is big. This is really big, not only for her as an artist, as an African-American woman, but it's big for her, you know, for people. You know, Ed Sullivan show was, I mean, it's the kind of thing, you know, Miss Ford, who we interviewed, I did an oral interview with her. She lives in New Orleans, and her grandmother and Mahalia were friends. And so when I found out about her and I called her, and so it was like she was explaining how Ed Sullivan was this iconic figure on television. All the children had to sit down, be quiet. She was saying, like, she remember her brother had to go to the bathroom and his grandma said, "Boy, sit down." And I mean, right now, you know, couldn't even go to the bathroom. But to be on that show, it changed everything. It put her on a, you know, it just put her on a whole scale in terms of a different audience. And again, crossing over to a different audience. Mm-hmm. So it did so much because he had that power because he had so many viewers. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of power and influence. So that was really, really big. And I remember Miss Ford explaining that her grandmother was just so emotional that Mahalia was on the Ed Sullivan show.
Well, the one thing that was interesting was that she said, "You must first sing for yourself. If I do nothing else, I hope to teach people that." And the Ed Sullivan show was a way to do that, like it was for the Beatles, like it was for Elvis. They had to sing like themselves first and foremost.
Yeah. And with her, though, I think that was just who she was, meaning. And when I look at that, when we wrote that, my thoughts were that it's got to feel right in here, which is why she always sang gospel and nothing else. If it didn't set right in here, she was not going to do it. And so, and I think she had a powerful understanding that when I do it based on how it affects me, then I know that the people that hear me will be affected. And Tim and I talk about this all the time, because if we're, you know, when we're even whatever work that you're doing, if you don't have an experience with it, if that work doesn't have, it's not, and especially as a singer, if something's not happening to me while the song is being sung, it's not going to affect the audience.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So that's kind of how I understood that. She was just going to be her authentic self, no matter itself, no matter where she was going to be her authentic self.
And I love
it was quite remarkable that she crossed over into millions of white listeners at a
Yes.
time when virtually no other Black artist had done so. Black artists followed in her footsteps, but you know, Sam Cooke, for example, incredible gospel singer who made his reputation that way. When he switched over, and he had to switch over into pop music in order to get to a wider audience beyond Black communities. But Mahalia stuck to this medium of traditional Black art form and a deeply religious form. And yet she became one of the country's leading vocalists.
One of the other things that's so interesting to me is the way you put her at the center of so much of Chicago's civil rights. You talk about how she integrated her neighborhood, that she had, you know, her house was fired upon by terrorists. There's no other word for it now. She was at the prayer pilgrimage in 1957. She was the friend and confidant of civil rights leaders who often stayed at her house and enjoyed her exceptional hospitality, too.
That's right. The southernness, Tim and I just talked about this. She never lost her southernness in terms of no matter how far she got, where, no matter in terms of the places. We know that, you know, we talk about the fact that she sang for several presidents. So we understand that Black communities, racial coalition, all of these things were important to her, and she poured everything she had into it. But that Southern New Orleans African-American woman, after they would do things, and we talk about this, they would be out, you know, in this community, and then she comes back, they all come to her house, they're all sitting around, she's frying chicken, you know, she is a Southern belle, and making them feel that warmth, that comfort, that peace, to be able to go back out and get the work done again. She was really known for that. It's hard to even explain how wonderful she was at establishing these relationships and maintaining them. Some of them very complex, we know, but she just had a way of making people feel at home. And for African-American preachers, we do try to bring that out, how that held a special place in her to do things for ministers or Black preachers. And so whenever she would do things, she's still reaching out into the community, helping with daycare centers and whatever she could assist with. It didn't matter whether the preacher was somebody she was involved with or not, but because a Black African-American preacher needed assistance, you know, she would help.
And she was right there at the I Have a Dream speech.
She had heard Martin Luther King speak a few weeks earlier in Detroit and give a powerful impromptu riff about the dream. And that wasn't in his speech that day in Washington at the Lincoln Memorial. She thought his speech was starting to fade toward the end a little. And she shouted out from nearby, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." And he immediately shifts into that timeless riff, kind of improvising from language he had used before and language that ran in him and made history.
Well, this is a book that's filled with that kind of grace and understanding, and it makes us all understand the music a little better and the woman who made it. We've been talking with Tim Tyson and Mary Williams, co-authors of a new biography, Mahalia Jackson, Moving On Up a Little Higher, The Story of an American Civil Rights Pioneer. Thank you both so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Joy to be
Thank
here.
You.
Here's what's on tap this week in the literary life. Books for Brews, the annual book drive benefiting Louisiana Books to Prisoners, will take place as part of the Brewtastic Book Fair, Saturday, August 1st, from 1 to 5 p.m. at Urban South Brewery. In addition to the book drive, there will also be bookish vendors and a school supply drive. Books to Prisoners is in need of new or excellent condition used paperback books in the following genres: fantasy, manga, and sci-fi. When you donate books, you will receive free beer. Poets Emily Smith, Jonathan Pinton, Jennifer Polson, Ed Ruska, read from their work at the Poetry Buffet, Saturday, August 1st at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Sherman Horn, an archaeology project manager with Goodwin and Associates, will discuss Maya cities in Belize at 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 4th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie as part of the regularly scheduled meeting of the Louisiana Archaeology Society. Historian Bradley W. Hart discusses New Orleans as the scene of a cat-and-mouse game between rival intelligence services in the years before World War II. That's on Thursday, August 6th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Jonathan Earle discusses in Science He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860. That's on Friday, August 7th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Nathaniel Rich signs his new novel, Cloud Thief, Friday, August 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Katie Simpson Smith discusses and signs the Maltese version, August 18th at 7 p.m. when she appears in conversation with C. Morgan Babst at Blue Cypress Books.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.